Blog Talk Radio.
Danton, who was one of the leaders and triumphant in the French Revolution, which overthrew the Bourbon monarchy. It's timely because of what's going on in the streets across America, in Greece, what happened in England, that these street people, some of them, we'll find out some of them from out of town, like many of the protesters here in San Francisco. And in Oakland, there's some from Ventura, California, which is Southern California. There are others from other parts of the country. When some of these people were interviewed, they're blithering illiterates. They don't know what they're there for. Apparently, there are allegations, credible allegations, that these people have been paid. But Danton, Robespierre, all those people eventually lost their heads. It's a revolution that gets out of control, and what eventually happens is it eats and destroys and excretes its own. Among the other interesting, talking about people who are going hungry, and there's a lot of unnecessary food that's thrown away because we still haven't worked out a system where people who claim to collect leftover food from the restaurants and stores, and even people who do dumpster diving for perfectly edible food, for some reason just don't get it to those who need it. We've been working on this project for several years now, and we'll be giving you some tips later on before the Thanksgiving and Christmas and New Year holidays. But on this day, Charles Post was born. He's the guy who, Dr. Kellogg in Michigan, Battle Creek, Michigan, who invented Kellogg's cornflakes, or created them, Charles Post created his own cereal, Post Toasties, and all of that. And one of the big socialites married a movie star. I think it was Cliff Robertson. And Mrs. Post was one of these socialites who tried to do some good, I guess. And then also today is the birthday of Leon Trotsky, was Russian Jewish. I don't think he practiced. The family name was Bronstein, and one of their descendants, the nephew, grandnephew, Philip Bronstein, was the editor of the old Hearst San Francisco Examiner. He's now floating editor with the San Francisco Chronicle. And so I think it's appropriate today to, I think we got Trotsky here. What happened to him? To feature some of the things that he talked about. Excuse me. I thought I put it here. Leon Trotsky. Shame on me if I didn't. We've got so many new things here. If I can't find it today, I will do it Friday because there was this horrible assassination inflicted on Trotsky when Stalin was had his NKVD, Cheka, and assassins pursue Trotsky all over the world. Trotsky ended up in Mexico in a gated compound, but this guy wormed his way in. His name was Mercator. They didn't have capital punishment in Mexico at the time. This is just before World War II. And he assassinated Trotsky with, I think, a pickaxe. And he spent 20 years in a Mexican jail and then went back to Russia. We don't know if he ended in a gulag or well-deserved retirement or what. But he disappeared off of the world view. Anyway, I thought that it was up here. We have so many interviews. We've got to edit our archives here. And so instead, it's also the important day for Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood, and she was arrested on this date for on charges of obscenity for promoting birth control. So to start, since this is the presidential season and it's part of our the political animal, then-candidate Barack Obama was talking about, was addressing Planned Parenthood. I don't know where the meeting was, but this is what we came out of the archives, recent archives. And so this is part one of what he, part of his speech that he gave to Planned Parenthood.
Thanks to all of you as Planned Parenthood for all the work that you are doing for women all across country and for families all across the country and for men who are have enough sense to realize you're helping them all across the country. I want to thank Cecile Richards for her extraordinary leadership. I'm happy to see so many good friends here today, including Steve Tromlett and Pam Sutherland from my home state of Illinois. We had a number of battles down in Springfield for many, many years, and it was wonderful to see that they are here today. So it's been a little over 5 months since I announced my candidacy for President of the United States of America. And everywhere we've been inspired by these enormous crowds. We had 20,000 people in Atlanta, 20,000 people in Austin, Texas, 15,000 people in Oakland, California. And I would love to take all the credit for these crowds myself, to say to myself that it's because I'm just so fabulous, but my wife says otherwise. Michelle, I think, confirmed that these crowds are not about me. It's about the hunger all across America. It's something different. It's about the sense that we can do better. That we come to a crossroads. That we're not pointed in the right direction. I look out over these crowds, and there's a wonderful cross-section of the country. Male, female, black, white, Hispanic, Asian, Native American, disabled, gay, straight, old, young. What I'm heartened to see is particularly the young people who are getting the first chance to be part of a larger movement of America. I see young women who are Ariana's age and younger. And I think about my own two daughters, Sasha and Malia. And sometimes it makes me stop and it makes me wonder, what kind of America will our daughters grow up in? What kind of America will our daughters grow up in? Will our daughters grow up with the same opportunities as our sons? Will our daughters have the same rights, the same dreams, the same freedom to pursue their own version of happiness? I wonder, because there's a lot at stake in this country today, and there's a lot at stake in this election, especially for our daughters. To appreciate that, all you have to do is review the recent decisions handed down by the Supreme Court of the United States. The first time in Gonzalez versus Carhart, the Supreme Court upheld a federal ban on abortion with criminal penalties for doctors. For the first time, the court endorsed an abortion restriction without exception for women's health. The decision presumes that the health of women is best protected by the court, not by doctors, and not by the woman herself. That presumption is wrong. Some people argued that the federal ban on abortion was just an isolated effort aimed at one medical procedure, but it's not part of a concerted effort to steadily roll back the hard-won rights of American women. That presumption is also wrong. Within hours of the decision, an Alabama lawmaker introduced a measure to ban all abortions. With one more vacancy on the court, we could be looking at a majority hostile to a woman's fundamental right to choose for the first time since Roe versus Wade, and that is what is at stake in this election. The only thing more disturbing than the decision was the rationale of the majority. Without any hard evidence, Justice Kennedy proclaimed it is self-evident that a woman would regret her choice. He cited medical uncertainty about the need to protect the health of pregnant women, even though the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists found no such uncertainty. Justice Kennedy knows many things. My understanding is he does not know how to be a doctor. He dismisses mere preferences, the reasoned judgment of the nation's doctors. Seen time after time these last few years, and the precedent says otherwise, when the science is inconvenient, when the facts don't match up with the ideology, they are cast aside. So it's time for us to change that. It is time for a different attitude in the White House. It is time for a different attitude in the Supreme Court. It is time to turn the page and write a new chapter in American history. We know that five men don't know better than women and their doctors what's best for a woman's health. We know that it's about whether or not women have equal rights under the law. We know that a woman's right to make a decision about how many children to have and when, without government interference, is one of the most fundamental freedoms we have in this country. We also know there was another voice that came from the bench, a voice clear in reasoning, compassion, and dissent. A voice that rejected what she called, quote, ancient notions of women's place in the family and under the Constitution, ideas that have long been discredited, unquote. One commentator called the decision in Gonzalez an attack on Ruth Bader Ginsburg's entire life's work. It was. But we heard Justice Ginsburg, and we know what she was saying. She was saying, we've been there before, and we are not going back. We refuse to go back. We know it's not just one decision. It's the both blows dealt to equal pay in the Ledbetter case. It's the blow dealt to integration in the school desegregation case. It's an approach to the law that favors the powerful over the powerless. It holds up a flawed ideology over the rights of the individual. We don't see America in these decisions. That's not who we are as a people. We're a country founded on the principle of equality and freedom. We're a country that fought generation after generation steadily extend that equality under the law to the many, not restrictions to the few. We've been there before, and we're not going back. I have worked on these issues for decades now. I put Roe the center of my lesson plan on reproductive freedom when I brought down the streets of the law, not simply as a case about privacy, but as part of the broader struggle for women's equality. Steve Tam will tell you that we fought together in the Illinois State Senate against restrictive choice legislation, laws just like the federal abortion laws, federal abortion bans that are cropping up. I've stood up for choice in the United States Senate, and I stand by my vote against the confirmation of Jeff Roberts and Samuel Alito. So you know where I think. But this is more than just about standing our ground. It must be about more than protecting the gains of the past. We're at a crossroads right now in America, and we have to move this country forward. This election is not just about playing defense, it's also about playing offense. It's not just about defending what is, it's about creating what might be in this country. And that's what we've got to work together on. There will always be people, many of goodwill, who do not share my view on the issue of choice. This fundamental issue, I will not yield, and Planned Parenthood will not yield. That doesn't mean that we can't find common ground, because we know that what's at stake is more than whether or not a woman can choose an abortion. Choice is about how we lead our lives. It's about our families. It's about our community. It's about our daughters and whether they're going to have the same opportunities as our sons. There are those who want us to believe otherwise. They want us to believe there's nothing that unites us as Americans. There's only what divides us. They'll seek out the narrowest and most divisive ground. That is the strategy, to always argue small instead of looking at the big picture. They will stand in the way of any attempt to find common ground. At a time when the real war is being fought abroad, they would have us fight culture wars here at home. But I am absolutely convinced that culture wars are just so 90s. Their days are growing dark. It is time to turn the page. We want a new day here in America. We're tired about arguing about the same old stuff.
We'll have part two Friday. Now, this is an interview done with Margaret Sanger, two of them, before she died. Now, we'll play that one.
Mrs. Margaret Sanger opened the first birth control clinic in the United States back in 1916. Birth control was a dirty word. The police threw her into jail, as they were to do seven more times during her crusade, a crusade that still faces the reasoning but unalterable opposition of the Roman Catholic Church. That crusade kept Mrs. Sanger away from her children for long periods. It helped to break up her first marriage, and she suffered constant, harrowing social abuse. Mrs. Sanger, in view of all of that, let me ask you this first of all. Why did you do it? I realize that you had an intellectual conviction that birth control was a boon to mankind, but I'm sure that others have that conviction too. And so what I'd like to know is this. What events, what emotions in your life made Margaret Sanger a crusader for birth control?
Well, Mr. Wallace, it's hard to say that any one thing has made one do this or that. I think from the very beginning, I came with a large family. My mother died young, 11 children, made an impression on me as a child. I was a trained nurse, went among the people. I saw women who asked to have some means whereby they wouldn't have to have another pregnancy too early after the last child, the last abortion, which many of them had. So there's a number of things that are one after the other that really made you feel that you had to do something.
There are some other possible reasons that suggest themselves. I'm reading your biography by Lawrence later. Your mother, as you say, died prematurely after bearing 11 children. She was born a Catholic, was she not?
She was born a Catholic, yes.
And your father was a sort of a village atheist who clashed with church authorities. And because of his atheism, his earnings dwindled under community pressure. You and your brothers and sisters were known as, quote, children of the devil, end quote. Could it be then that in part at least, you were driven emotionally toward the birth control movement because of antagonism toward the church, because that was a way to fight the church?
No, I don't think I had anything of the kind in mind. I was what I would call a born humanitarian. I don't like to see people suffer. I don't like to see cruelty, even to this day. And in nursing, you see a great deal of cruelty and unnecessary suffering. At that time, there was no opposition as far as the church was concerned, any church. It was mainly the law, the federal law and state law that one had to think of. The church was not in my mind at all.
Well, then going after your motives then, and I will press you just a little bit more about that and then get to the specifics of the business. But in your motive, in the movement, is it possible that the movement itself, the feeling of wanting to do anything that you felt was important, that perhaps that moved you a good deal? Because the fact remains that you led a movement against overwhelming pressures that stemmed back for centuries. And in doing so, according to your autobiography, you even left your first husband. And you wrote this to a friend, Mrs. Sanger. You said, "Where is the man to give me what the movement gives in joy and interest and freedom?" Now, what was this joy, this freedom that you craved?
Well, I don't remember that letter that was written, but I think that it was not a question of marriage at all. There was a certain satisfaction in doing something that was going to alleviate the sufferings of women in particular, and I was quite a feminist at the time.
Mm-hmm, obviously.
And I naturally didn't want to see women take all the suffering of childbearing and of pregnancies. So it was a pleasure in a sense, I think, that you were striking at an archaic law, which it was, put on the statute book by Anthony Comstock some years ago, and no one had stood up against it, no one had tried to change the laws. And at that time, not even a doctor had a right to use the United States mails and common carriers for books, for learning, or anything that he had to do with this question. It was considered obscene. The whole question was considered obscene.
Mrs. Sanger, you have helped to spread the birth control movement not only here in the United States, but in Europe and the Orient as well. Why? Why is birth control of such vital importance internationally? Is it just to save women suffering? Is that the only reason in your mind?
Well, not entirely. The population question is a great concern today, and the rate at which the births come in to the... We're saving them now. At one time, when children died, they didn't have the food. Today, our population all over the world is getting certainly better consideration and better conditions than they had at the time that I was there. I went to every country because I was invited, and I didn't spread go into the country myself. I was invited to go to Japan and to speak there, have 8 lectures on the question of birth control and peace.
Well, do you believe that birth control is essential if we want to keep millions of people across the world from starving? Is that your thesis?
Say it again.
Do you feel that birth control is essential to keep millions of people across the world from starving?
Well, I think the birth control, if you keep the population more or less static until you pick up your resources, certainly you'll keep, prevent their starving.
Well, what's more important, birth control or picking up the resources?
Well, picking up the resources, there's just a limit to that, too. There's just so much, take Japan. And she cannot feed. They've had the best experts come there when MacArthur was there. And the best experts have said they have 20 million more people and they can feed. She's got to be fed outside. And in some way, she's got to have that kind of help if she's going to keep them fighting.
But certainly around the world, there is potential agricultural land that is not being properly used now. Just this past year, on May 21st, the New York Times summarized an important study of the work of Professor James Bonner of the California Institute of Technology. Professor Bonner says the world is not using 1 billion acres of potential agricultural land, and he adds that if this land were used and present agricultural land were improved, the entire world could be fed adequately, even if the population increased by 1/3 in the next 50 years.
Oh, Mr. Wallace, you hear so many.
There's another part to this, and we'll play that now. This is what Margaret Sanger said. Children are the greatest sin. This is interesting reasoning. It's very short.
Do you believe in sin? When I say believe, I don't mean believe in committing sin. Do you believe there is such a thing as sin?
Well, I think the biggest sin in the world is bringing children into the world that have the disease from their parents, that have no chance in the world to be a human being, practically. Delinquents, prisoners, all sorts of things just mocked when they're born. That, to me, is the greatest sin.
We'll continue with this Friday, and we'll play the other half of the Obama speech. It was a long one to Planned Parenthood. Today also is the birthday of the father of the English Navy, King Alfred the Great. He had to fight the Vikings, and so he put together these ships to fend them off. And, of course, Henry VIII had his fleet. And then, of course, Elizabeth had her fleet to fight off the Spanish Armada. And then the English had this policy of 1,000 ships to cover the world, which was their, most of it was their empire. Among the other, I lost my sheet here, sorry, other things that happened today. I goofed. But anyway, we're going to resume Friday with the political animal, and these are anecdote speeches and other acts and activities and comments from presidential candidates, and we'll have more of the debates. We have to go through our archives to get this, and we'll also have more on Margaret Sanger. Now, Margaret Sanger supposedly was the nurse who treated Adolf Hitler. We're still trying to verify this, so we don't be making outrageous statements, but I've heard this. I haven't seen it, and when I find it, if I find it, we'll bring it up. So we'll end with our usual theme, politics and poker. So maybe some of these guys, instead of duking it out in the debates, maybe they should sit down, Romney and Perry, and sit down and have a game of poker and see who has the best hand. So here goes.
I got too much on my mind to play poker.
King bet.
Cost you $5. Tony, up to you.
Hey, Tony, what are you
going to
do?
I'm in.
So am I.
Fight, wine. Me too.
Gentlemen, here we are, and one thing is clear. We gotta pick a candidate for Congress this year.
Big Ace.
Ace bet.
You'll pay through the nose.
Okay, where do you stand?
I'm in.
So am I.
Likewise.
Here goes.
Possible straight. Possible flush. Nothing.
Gentlemen, how about some names we can use? Some qualified Republican who's willing to lose.
Out of bounds, we should make Jack Riley the judge.
Which Riley are you thinking of, Jack B or Jack Y?
I say neither one. I never even met him.
I say when you got a pair of jacks, bat out.
Poker, which is more important?
Parrot raise.
Bet 'em.
Little trade, good as gold.
I'll say.
Raise your five.
I'll call.
I'll hold.
I'll raise your back.
I think you're bluffing.
Put your money where your mouth is.
Okay, I'm in.
Gentlemen, no.
knock it off and let's get this done.
Try Michael Fajicinkovich, I'm certain he'd run.
Mike is out, I'm afraid he just wouldn't sell. Nobody likes a candidate whose name they can't spell.
That was the problem with Paulini, and I kept saying it. So anyway, we'll be back Friday at 3 o'clock, and there'll be some new broadcasts. We'll tell you what we're planning, and we're going through all our archives. We've got close to 2,000 interviews and archives and stuff from Western Public Radio and KLW and stuff from the Carson Brazola Historical Audio, Print, and Video Archives. Good night.